Reading about alcoholism in Time magazine, I fit the profile. I'm unable to choose whether I drink or not, and if I do, I'm unable to stop. I help my friends along with their drinks, too. When people tell me I'm drunk, I get mad and sulk. I have to continually ask what happened the night before. I realize that these Sundays, which are so confusing, agitating, and sometimes hallucinatory, are in fact a form of DTs. I can't understand anyone who drinks not becoming an alcoholic. On one of these Sundays, phone rang. It was Danny, who asked me to come over and look after Nico, who's just arrived from Ibiza. Yes! I ran up Fifth, entered Danny's, and sure enough, there in his bed, in black Moroccan robes, is Nico herself. Enormous candid eyes fixed on us, shorn of eyebrows. I fixed us some vodka and grapefruit drinks, and we began to talk, she in the deepest, slowest, most Germanic voice imaginable. I asked her about her old lovers, Clementi.
Once you're crazy, you're always crazy.
Dillon.
He races horses now.
She showed a picture of the kid they had together, Ari. Cute. We agreed that Lou Reed now looks like a dead monkey. I played her Roxy music, which she'd never heard of, and told her that Eno called her the best rock singer in history. Danny was working on an article in the other room. Nico disappeared to the little girl's room. We heard a loud boom from the kitchen. Danny and I both ran there to see what had happened. He shot me a disapproving look, since I was meant to be the babysitter. Nico was splayed out in the kitchen floor, legs akimbo. We all looked at each other in silence, and then slowly, very slowly, Nico started to laugh.
Ho, ho, ho.
Then we all started to laugh at the big, exotic loony bird on the floor. I was telling her about the new New York band called Television that's really good, kind of like her old band, the Velvets. They're playing tonight. We should go. So we cab down to CBGB. I walk in with Nico, and there's Eno fiddling at a mixing board. He's making demos of Television. He looks up, sees me, who he always snubs, sees Nico, then gives me a big smile. Duncan, hello! How are you? Ha! I make introductions. Eno, this is Nico. Nico, this is Eno. He took it from there. My work was done. I loved my afternoon with Nico. Went to see the 3.5-hour The Mother and the Whore starring Jean-Pierre Léo. After, I found Donald Lyons at Max's and talked to him about it, and he said, it exposes the French male for what he really is, a fast talker. The two women around him are merely an audience, don't you think? Sure, I guess, but to me, it's just another portrait of Léo, the self-centered Parisian, who never quite manages to get his coolness to come off properly. He's just an overgrown child. Christian and I go over to Steve Paul's to watch the Dick Cavett show. He's got the Loud family on, 1 year after their celebrated documentary, An American Family. Steve was lying on his blue velvet bed, watching the broadcast projected on a huge screen. He was smoking something called stickweed that sells for $20 a joint. I was drinking Kahlua. The Louds were all bitching at each other. Lance was fidgeting, hogging all the airspace. Weird watching it with Christian, who was part of it. Then their band, Loud, plays their song Muscle Boys. Lance was trying too hard, phrasing like David Johansen, bunching all his words up. The sound was poorly mixed. Michelle and Delilah's backup singing was flat. Christian was at the piano in the background, just a silhouette. Also, Christian was right next to me, dismayed at how poorly the band was coming off. Steve was moaning and groaning at the travesty of it all. Christian bowed his head, his face obscured by curls, and pretended to be fascinated with a blue ashtray on the blue onyx end table. Really, he was crying. Poor sweet Christian. I have a new gay friend, Norman Fisher. He's a middle-aged Floridian gent, resembles Montgomery Clift. He's an art collector and a cocaine dealer. Lives on Madison, just below the Whitney. He never goes out, just stays in, surrounded by his collection of Art Deco, Americana, toys, cookie jars, Buddy Holly records, plastic gas stations with forklifts that really work, molded railroad tunnels, and Ed Ruscha's. He orders hamburgers from Burger Heaven downstairs. He sits at his desk, weighing white powder, and puts small spoonfuls of it up his nose. He offers me the mirror with the lines all neatly laid out. I hoover it up, wait for the numbing sensation between the eyes, acrid taste. I sip my red wine and light one of his menthol cigarettes. He looks up from his work and says, "I hate straight people," just so I know the score. Right on cue, Taylor Mead shambles in with his hilarious sad sack face. He tells a funny story about his latest drunk with Gloria Swanson. I remind him of the couple of hours I spent at his apartment after Max's one night. He puts a dopey look in his face and says, "I'm sorry, I'm kind of burnt out." I hit the street and walk up to the Sabarsky Gallery, where they're showing my hero, Egon Schiele. Fantastic! They cost $49,000. I've been trying to draw like him. I'd love to play him in a movie. Such a great story. Dead at 28. Great haircut. I'm in three shows at Parsons. I'm showing two nudes in the photo show, one of Kramer in an electrified bathtub, grinning madly, holding a goblet of wine, penis tip bobbing at the surface. The other is Eden, squinting at the light, featuring her high, compact breasts. My new illustrations are painted flatly from photographs in offbeat, muted colors. I've been looking at Van Dongen. 2 years ago at Bard, I was sitting in a darkened lecture hall, following the march of art history. Then de Kooning blazes on the screen. I woke up. His paintings actually scared me. Even looking at the slides exhausted me. I couldn't imagine the scope that this white-haired magician had. This sliding into this, colliding with this, which leads over to that. Sploosh! Like a piece of theater captured on canvas. Something very dramatic happened here, at great speed, too. 2 years later, I'm still in a darkened lecture hall, still smoking cigarettes, looking at the history of illustration, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, hoping I will have a job when I graduate in a year's time. Microscope, 1974. April, 1974. The Rites of Spring in Lower Manhattan. A fresh journal to catch all my scraps. Taking it in and spitting it out. Someday this will be a bygone era. Christian Hoffman and I were on a teeter-totter in Riverside Park. Evening sky pink over the Hudson. We're talking about this artist we met, Richard Gallo. He wears scary sadomasochism outfits, black leather hoods, fishnet bodysuits with the shadow of his pubic hair and shaft, clothespins on his nipples to make him bigger. That's his art. A surprisingly nice guy. We talked about Jean-Louis Trintignant, who we love. Christian says we're typically American. Speak for yourself, I cry in protest. Just like an American to go around pretending he's French, he countered. Last week, Danny, Lisa Robinson, Christian, and I went to see the Dolls at Club 82. They wore dresses and wigs in deference to the drag club's 30-year history. Plus, their usual paraphernalia, of platform boots, cap pistols, feather boas, and Jerry's bubblegum pink drum set. Killer Kane, the outsized bass player, wore a baby pacifier around his neck. David's singing, "Somebody stole my baby." A fight breaks out on the dance floor, so David Johansen, in his best Altamont style, says, "Be cool, kids. Get another drink. Just be a little cool. Dig yourselves, children." He threw silver Hershey's Kisses to the audience. They played a great new song called Mystery Girls. Lisa Robinson picked me up in a cab that stank of perfume. Took me to see the Dolls again at the Bottom Line, where they opened for Detroit's Susie Quattro, glam pop princess who wore a form-fitting silver zippered bodysuit, super sexy in her shag and low-slung guitar. We left with our ears ringing. Spring Summer Movies. Women in Love, fourth time. Savage Messiah. The Boyfriend, third time. Any Number Can Win, Delon, Gabin. Love and Anarchy, All About Eve. Borsellino, sixth time. Malizia, Laura Antonelli. Blonde Venus, Public Enemy. Spring Summer Records. Out of Borstal, Fresh. Diamond Dogs, David Bowie. Journey, Colin Blundstone. Rock Bottom, Robert Wyatt. Romance is on the Rise, Genevieve Waite. Spring Summer Books. I, Jan Kramer. Claudine at School, Colette. Justine, Desaad. City of Night, Rishi. One of my teachers, with the unfortunate name of Murray Tinkleman, looks through my portfolio and says, "No way you're not going to be a smash. You're good, odd, contemporary, classic, autobiographical." He goes on to say that art is an entrance, a state of crisis. Let it find itself. I actually did a plein air painting of the plaza in the Essex House while sitting atop a large boulder in Central Park. It wasn't bad, but it's baffling juggling all that visual information when it's right in front of you. I prefer using photographs, which already pare things down. I go downstairs to Cinemabilia to say hi to Richard Hell, who wears Godardian dark glasses, has unruly hair, nicotine-stained teeth, and fleshy lips. Big, sloppy grin. He's a runaway from Kentucky. He's only been playing bass for 6 months, but television is sounding better and better. Lenny Kay called them the golden apple at the top of the tree. Danny said, "They're finally here, in full pathological innocence." Nicholas Ray said, without ever hearing them, "Four cats with a passion." Being a student of pop history, I'd always regretted being born too late for the birth of scenes like The Who at the Marquee or The Stones at Eel Pie Island. But maybe this embryonic scene is mine. I'm at the right place at the right time at the right age. This is our music. Eden's back in town after her convalescence from hepatitis. No longer yellow, but still temperamental. Maybe just mental. We go to Club 82 to see Television, who are doing a residency there. We descended the mirror stairs. There's Lance Loud, filled with manic energy in his Angels t-shirt, with Christian, who's cut off his lion's mane. There's Dupre, who yells out at a passing Johnny Thunders, "You're all washed up, Thunders!" Dupre loves to get his goat. And who should sit right behind me? Brian Ferry. He's on my turf, listening to Hell as he sings, "I'm thinking, your thoughts." They break into Hard on Love, the Jagged Friction. I learned later that Brian thought they were out of tune, but had great visual appeal. The following night, I went back. Waiting in a short line to get in, I heard someone say, "Hello, David." So I turned around to look at the back of a henna-haired Bowie cut, one of thousands the city over. But wait, this was no ordinary Ziggy Doo. This was the original. 'Twas Aladdin Sane himself, standing right next to me, dressed in a quilted lavender space top, white Levi's and flat dance shoes. My height! He turned, face too pale, black eyeliner, weary. He looked like he hadn't eaten in months. I nodded, and he nodded back. I caught a glimpse of one of his fangs as he and Ava Cherry were whisked in to a cordoned-off corner table. I checked on him later, and he was engrossed in conversation with a slightly chubby black-haired guy who had a Long Island look about him. "Who dat, I wonder?" "Oh, no, it's the Electric Warrior, Mark Bolan, already past his prime. Two former mods come to check out the New York Underground. We have arrived." Bowie said they were the best band he'd seen from New York City. Trouble with Eden. Nobody else makes me feel so lousy. Nobody else makes me feel so good. She's a lost lamb in a glass city. Well, maybe not a lamb. We were walking down St. Mark's Place after a dinner of cheap roast pork lo mein, and a dude stops her and says, "You a ghost. What's the matter with you, girl? You high or something? You showing off your buoy." Went on a bus to visit Dupre on a Saturday night in Rutherford, New Jersey, where he's finishing up college at Fairleigh Dickinson, or Fairleigh Ridiculous, as he says. The air was sweet. Smelled like spring. The dark, empty streets echoed like Rod Serling's off-kilter America. Twilight Zone teens sitting on stoops. We retired to a small room to work on a stolen fifth of scotch and listen to Rebel Rebel over and over on his tinny Mickey Mouse record player. His Stratocaster in the corner, next to a stack of well-used Playboys. A painting of mine on the wall called Upstairs Maid. These are the kind of haunts where plans are hatched, then scrapped, then hatched again. Sunday I hit Max's looking for some fun and found Richard Lloyd. I offered to buy him a drink, and he said, "No, better yet, follow me. I know where we can get free tequila." So we go over to some guy's apartment a couple blocks away and downed 10 or 11 tumblers. He faced me, red in the face, and told me I was a face, part of the television entourage, someone at all their gigs who spreads enthusiasm. At the dawn of a new day, etc. He was very earnest. At 5 a.m. we parted. I was so drunk that I got lost on the way home, staggering down Avenue A under the horror film street lamps. Where am I? A car pulled up. A hand snatched the 30-year-old Black Dobbs gangster hat off my head and tore away. Fuck! Back to television. I was at Max's. Someone was hassling tough little Elda from the Stilettos over $100 bill, and it turned into a catfight. Elda screaming, "Fuck!" as the assailant pulled on her hair. Gallant, Richard Hell, joined the brawl. Blows were exchanged. I moved off. Hell crashed on my table. The legs buckled. Wood splintered. Hell on the floor. Lying in the debris. Shades broken. Chickpeas everywhere. I sat in a booth with intense Tom Verlaine, and we had a staring match. We both snickered at the same time. May 26, 1974. Eden and I broke up. She wanted all or nothing. Nothing it is then. No longer under her microscope. Just this morning she had sworn never-ending devotion to me as she guided me into her snapper. Now flown the coop. First plane back to the Twin Cities. It's for the best. Meanwhile, Eric Lee and I find a railroad apartment at 174 Thompson Street, number 5FN, across the street from Rocco's Italian restaurant. The huge men's shelter on Bleecker is just in the corner. $210 a month, two bedrooms, tub in the slanted kitchen, high ceilings, arched windows, hot and cold running cockroaches, ancient moldings. We filled it with junk furniture that Eric got for free at Columbia. $40 for a moving van. We painted the living room pink. My first apartment. We have a temporary pal crashing in the living room floor. J.D. Doherty, who's a drummer and loud. Christian's over here using the typewriter and singing a Patti Smith parody. And then Rimbaud, he got my toe, and I was hot and bad. And then came Brian Jones. I saw Patty in the laundromat on Thompson Street. She said she was washing my old man's socks. Very unliberated of her, I thought. Patty asked if I knew a piano player she could use, so I suggested Eric. He practiced with her a couple of times, but she cut him off during Land of a Thousand Dances, saying, "Hey, Eric, when I sing Do You Know How to Pony, I'm not talking about dancing." She gave him a lecture about rock and sex. Eric turned scarlet. He may not get the job due to his shyness. One last dinner at the Plaza with Stone Steve Paul. As we entered, I winked at the lobsters in their death row tank. It was the last mile for those scaly red monsters. One lucky lobster was about to become my dinner. As we ate, with much noisy sucking and chewing from Steve, his nose glistening in the subdued lighting, sending reflective beams across the room, he went on about his favorite subject, genius and insanity. The ones who went too far out there couldn't be responsible caretakers of their own genius. A friend of his was just found with 80 stab wounds in his body, plus his hands and feet had been removed by a homicidal male hustler. Lance comes to visit on a June afternoon. Horizontal light through the Venetian blinds. He teases me about my looks. He says he was visiting Danny recently, who got out his Duncan Hanna photo book and raved, "Look at the beauty! What a beauty!" Then Lance makes up a little ditty. "Beauty equates Duncan. Duncan is beauty, la 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 la." "Okay, okay, I get it already." Wicked Lance. He says, "Giad," for God, and uses the phrase snob appeal a lot. We talk about the Kinks. It's 10 at night. Eric and I lived on baked beans and peanut butter, lettuce, and mayonnaise sandwiches all week. There's a plastic revolver floating in our toilet bowl. I guess this means I've solved the case. The windows of the air shaft are open, and I can hear the Italian mother shouting, "Hey, Angelo, you know what I'm gonna do if you're not up here in 10 minutes? I lie in bed and write 7 postcards to people. One to my sister, who's been on a tear about that creep, Richard Nixon, and the Watergate scandal. One to sex kitten Lucy Hood, who was always game for a roll in the hay with me. Even named her pussycat Duncan. Speaking of Eros, I haven't christened my new bed yet. I look over at a still from Breathless, taped to the wall. Belmondo in bed with Seberg. He's gently holding her chin, trying to convince her to run away to Rome with him before the dragnet closes in on him. June 4th, 1974. I got a summer job. I'm a cashier and sandwich boy at Sutter's French Bakery on 10th Street and Greenwich Avenue. I sit in a booth and punch buttons for $2.65 an hour, 32 hours a week. All the waiters are homosexual. As they pass me, they pinch my ass and say, "Those buns belong in a bakery!" Much shrieking laughter. When someone does a good quip, the ringleader, Wayne Hooper, says, "She peed. She peed all over the stage." Roxy Music at the Academy of Music. Stood around in the lobby during the openers. Sharks, bad. Talking with rock writers Michael Gross and Ron Ross, and Christian, who's been drawing Donny Osmond for 16 Magazine. A couple of dolls, milk and cookies, etc. Apparently, Atlantic Records is throwing Roxy a big party after, that we all must attend. But how? Jungle noises came from the theater, so we scrambled to our seats. Out came Roxy to much excitement and blasted into Editions of You, Virginia Plain, The Bob, If There Is Something, Grey Lagoons, A Song for Europe, Serenade, Mother of Pearl, Remake, Remodel, and of course, Do the Strand. They were tight. Brian was doing a sort of twist, and when he unbuttoned his white dinner jacket, slid his hand into his black tuxedo pants to reveal a crimson cummerbund, there was much applause. The band had the manic theatrics of Bill Haley and the Comets, like Andy Mackay's upside-down saxophone, Eddie Jobson's violin solos, Phil Manzanera's blazing guitar, Paul Thompson's propulsive drums. Power! There's the sci-fi element, chance meeting, a single spot on Brian, while a lone oboe mournfully rose above a wash of Mellotron. A slowed-down version of Pajamarama brought tears to my eyes. The crowd went crazy. Christian Lance and I got the address of the party and walked to the entrance of Larry River's loft on East 14th Street. There was already a crowd of people who couldn't get in. Jane Forth, Donna Jordan, Cindy Lang. Not looking good. Apparently, 50 people were invited, 100 max. We went up to the security guy at the door, just to give it the old college try. No soap. The band pulled up in a couple of Rolls Royces and ascended the steps to a cry from the crowd. Then, gay pop star from outer space Jabriath pulled up, with Mallory. I've slept with her. I asked Mallory if I could join her, so she asked Jabriath, who looked at me and my hungry posse, and said, "Just you, not your friends." I gave a farewell glance and hustled behind Mallory. It's every man for himself. Up to the fifth floor, into the portals of the star-studded party. I went over to the bar, where Danny introduced me to big, tall Brian Ferry, hair flopping over his eye in a blue velvet jacket. I tried to engage him in conversation about the show, but he just kept saying, "Yeah? Really?" as if his mind were on other things. I moved over to my savior, Mallory, who said, "Aren't you in heaven? Don't you love this party?" We had to clear out the crowded, 20 people, bathroom for Jabriath, who sits down to pee like a girl. They burst in anyhow, and Jabriath began to cry. We had a couple more drinks. I adjusted my bow tie and said, "Look, there's David Bowie," and I sidled over to him. He graced me with a glance, and I asked him if he was collecting material for a new song at this very minute. He sneered his canines at me and said, "Yeah, why? Do you want to be in my song?" I sneered back, "Yeah, what about it?" We kept up our grimaces like a couple of thugs, necks outstretched, until he broke out laughing. "No, sorry, I was just kidding. I didn't mean it, really." Then he said he liked my suit. "I stole it from you," I said, and he laughed some more. He took a swig from a can of Schaefer's beer and shifted his feet as I looked at all the colors in his hair. We chit-chatted a bit more. Then Ava Cherry came over and whisked him away. "So, I spied with my little eye blonde photographer Eric Bowman, John Warner, Richard Bernstein, Sean Cassidy, and Lisa Robinson running around getting in everyone's photographs. Pretty hustler Jimmy Sweeney. I told Andy Mackay he looked like Troy Donahue. He agreed. I went to Brian again, tried to engage him in a discussion about Alain Delon, the icon of Euro romance. He seemed confused and raised his glass to me and said, "Well, I've got to move along now. Get drunk." "Okay, who's next?" "Aha! There's John Phillips and his wife, Genevieve Waite, who I've had a big crush on for years." I brazenly went over and tapped on her bare shoulder. She turned, looking a bit wan in her peroxided hair with dark roots showing. "Yes?" I'm afraid I gushed. Told her about how I'd seen Joanna 5 times, had a poster of her in my kitchen, how I draw her all the time. Is it true you're going to be in a Broadway musical? Blah, blah, blah. She looked at me patiently and then introduced me to her husband, who gave me a get-out-of-here-kid look. I get it. I'm a pest. A biento, Joanna. I moved over to the youngest of Roxy, Eddie Jobson, who told me Brian gets girls for him after the shows. At that moment, Brian whistled for Eddie, motioned with his finger for him to come over, as he had a, presumably, willing redhead at his side. Across the room, I saw Nureyev and Fontaine, very briefly, exiting a freight elevator. Earl McGrath, Ahmet Erdogan, Taylor Mead, Holly Woodlawn, the Warhol superstars, Warhol himself. The bar began to close up. Everyone was going on to Club 82 for a nightcap. In the ensuing confusion, I somehow wound up in a hired car with Warhol, Ferry, and Bowie. Good company. I kept my mouth shut now because I was practically legless with alcohol. We entered the 82, where I promptly sat down at a bench, not trusting myself to stay vertical. I inadvertently tripped one of those Diesel Dyke bouncers, who picked me up to chuck me out. Jabriath, of all people, stopped her and pleaded my case. Hey, look, I'm as drunk as he is. You might as well throw me out, too. I'll make sure he doesn't get into any trouble. To no avail. She carried me up to the door and tossed me into the gutter, just like in the movies. The famous gutter that I've heard so much about. I made it! Now, here's where it gets weird. The next thing I know, it's morning. I wake up in a deserted room with no recall. On the floor, in my party clothes, bow tie, spectator shoes, double-breasted suit, silk shirt, and a little Mary Quant makeup. No furniture, no nothing. This is not my new apartment. Doesn't look like anybody's apartment. I get up and gingerly walk over to the window. Look down at the rubble of a vacant lot. Is this even New York? Dresden? I walk into the hallway, cradling my throbbing head. No one anywhere. I climb down many stairs, trying to find the exit from this dilapidated maze. I'm stuck in a bad dream? At last I found the door to the sidewalk. Blazing sun. I hobble down the street until I spot a black guy and say politely, "Excuse me, could you tell me where I am?" He sizes me up and down and grins from ear to ear. "You in the wrong part of town, motherfucker. And if you didn't look like such a sorry-ass clown, I'd kill you." Then he bursts into laughter. "Thank you," I said, and proceeded down the bombed-out street. I finally saw a sign that said 135th and Lenox Avenue. Wow! How the hell did I get up here? 133 blocks north, with no money? Up to the 5th floor of a condemned building? No explanation came to me. I made my way to a subway, hopped a turnstile, and got on a southbound train. In my confusion, I got off at the Battery, which was a giant excavation site. I tried to take what I thought was a shortcut, but in fact was just a huge expanse of industrial landfill. A yellow Caterpillar tractor turned on its axis and began rumbling towards me. I could see a brawny man in the cabin, laughing maliciously. "He wants to run me over." I started to run. He increased his speed. I flashed on North by Northwest, my only frame of reference for this scenario. Crop duster equals murderous tractor. I could hardly breathe, my heart exploding in my frail chest. I finally made it to Thompson Street at 9 a.m., made it to my new job at 11 a.m. I worked a 6-hour shift, about to die at any given second. From the height of glamour to the depths of squalor, all in one crazy night. Eden has been back in Minneapolis for 3 weeks, and I hear she's engaged to Kramer. Fast work. So much for broken hearts. Baisez-moi. Saw Breathless again last night. It's my mother lode, my Rosetta Stone. New York Herald Tribune headline says, Police identify road killer as Michelle Picard. Belmondo says, I always fall for the wrong dames. But this mouse is full of light. Saw The Who at the Garden last night. We got seats that were meant for Danny and Lisa Robinson. Moon was leaping around the stage yelling, Hey, Townsend looks bored. Pete was entangled in all his cords and wires. Daltrey flew at the PA system and it crashed to the floor. Entwistle sang Boris the Spider. Still, they were off. Eric and I walked to Max's thinking of the Brian Ferry lyric. With every goddess a let down, every idol a bring down, it gets you down. We got to Max's, and we were invited over to Terry York and Richard Lloyd's booth. We talk about the Patti Smith single Terry just put out, Hey Joe, with the excellent flip side, Piss Factory. Patti is having a secret affair with Verlaine now, although everybody knows about it except her boyfriend, Alan Lanier, who's away on tour. Terry laughs and says it's good PR. He told me to start a television fan club, whatever that means. He told me to call it Stay Tuned or TV Guide. I asked Richard how he got his money. I'm a whore, he said calmly. Oh, I replied. That really made Terry laugh. Terry is a consumer of the 53rd and 3rd Hustlers himself. Lloyd and I walked down to the 82, and he told me the story of his life. Growing up in Greenwich Village with bohemian parents. Says he knows the village brick by brick. About the shock treatment he was given in the asylum. He explained what a sexual deviant he is. How he tried to kill Terry once. About how he's wishing for an early death. How he's got no friends. Inside Club 82, we smoked some pot with a Bowie lookalike. I realized the city is German-American artist Richard Lindner's future shock vision come true, bound in vinyl leopard skin and white pompadours. Weimar Berlin all over again. In walk Entwistle and Moon, very drunk, with far-off looks in their eyes. The groupies hurriedly jump into action, to put a notch in their belts. To fuck a who? They probably didn't reckon on the abuse Moon was shelling out. We watched from the sidelines as Moon hit the dance floor, doing a macabre version of an angry escaped lunatic. Pretending to cram his fist up his frightened dancing partner's fashionable crotch, screaming at her what a stupid slut she was. Lloyd was telling me how he got to be friends with Moon in L.A. Well, introduce me to your friend then, I said. What, now? He said. No time like the present. So, we sidled over to the bar, where Moon was now guzzling alcohol like he'd never get another chance. Richard stood at his side and tentatively said, Hi, Keith. Sweaty Moon turned to glare at him, quite fearsome to see, and said, What the fuck do you want, cunt? Why don't you fuck off? Richard and I walked away. I guess he doesn't remember, I said. Dupre has moved in with me and Eric for a while, lugging his little amplifiers. He sleeps on the living room floor. He's joining Lance and Christian's band, Loud. Dupre has such an expressive face. It registers all the mischief, pain, glee, and sadness that's roiling around in his psyche. So now we're breathing in each other's animal odors. The place is impossible to keep clean. We have no closets, so our glad rags lie in untidy piles on the floor. My second-hand bed is lumpy and tilted. I can hear Eric moaning in his sleep through the wall. The cockroaches get fatter and more content every day. We listen to Bowie's Diamond Dogs constantly. Don't talk of dust and roses, or should we powder our noses? The downstairs neighbors complain about the noise we make. I've never seen Dupre so happy. We're having the time of our life. The phone number is 477-1198. The phone is ringing, but I ain't answering. I'm busy. Dupre got a job working at the same cafe as me, where we pilfer grub for our dinner and money from the cash register for drink. I look out from my cashier's booth, having erotic fantasies about the fresh, freckled, and arrogant jailbait that frequent the place, daydreaming to combat the dreariness. Sometimes lovebirds Tom Verlaine and Patti Smith come in for the tuna salad platter. I slipped a note in the tuna under a tomato. I watch as it gets caught in Patty's teeth. Rang up zero when they came to pay. They drift out, entwined, walking and making out. Public display is a big part of a Manhattan romance, Ork once said of the lovers. Last night Dupre and I went to Max's. We got a small table in the back room. Bowie's John, I'm Only Dancing was playing. Great song. Television entered straight from a rehearsal. They were incredibly soiled and wrinkled. We switched to their booth. Lloyd was his usual earnest, semi-corny, excited self. Some reference was made to the effect that Hal is an occasional user of hard drugs, i.e. heroin. Bob Plotnick, a.k.a. Bleaker Bob, the obnoxious record store owner and self-important legend in his own mind, stepped up, looking for trouble. He starts yelling at Hal because he didn't show up in the recording studio for a mixing. Bob's ponied up some cash for their first single. Hal said it was unavoidable, pursing his chapped lips, so piss off, man. Plotnick burns with rage. You need some manners. You gotta start practicing your bass because you're the shittiest bass player in the world. Hal calmly says, yeah, and you need a new mother and a new father, a new brain, and a new heart. You need a new face, a new body. You need new eyes, nose, and new teeth. Plotnick twitches. His eyes bug. He leaves. Verlaine says to Hal, oh, man, are you stupid? You gotta play along with an obnoxious bastard like that. You gotta eat crow. Lloyd nods affirmatively and says, I've eaten more crow than anyone on this planet. Plotnick returns, says, the Max's gig is off. The 82 Club is off. Forget it. He leaves. Verlaine follows him out, telling him that Hal is mentally ill. Plotnick says, I don't care. In 30 years, no one has ever talked to me like that. I'm going to see that he's murdered by tomorrow morning, whether by my bare hands, he's a black belt in karate, or by my relatives, Polish gangsters. They both return. Plotnick has worked himself up into an insane temper, building by the second. It is incredibly tense. Verlaine and I are holding our heads in our hands. Lloyd looks like he's about to cry. Hell's going to be killed. Plotnick is screaming at him to come outside to back up his lip like a man before he breaks his windpipe on the spot. Hal is now trying to apologize. But Plotnick is saying, no way. The only way you're going to pay for this is with your life. I'm going to kill you, man. You're dead. Plotnick was violently banging the bench back and forth, pulling the bolts out of the wall, staring off into the middle distance with a retarded look. Hal is contrite. Look, I know you can break my bones, man. I'm not going to fight you. I'm sorry. After what seemed an eternity, Plotnick's tone suddenly changed. It was a standoff. He left. Hal hiccuped. I thought those were my last words on Earth. July 3rd, 1974. Hot time, summer in the city. I had a housewarming party, and groupies Mallory and Velvet showed up, along with the rest of the gang. The degenerate soiree led to a 2-week fling with a Parsons girl, Mary Jane, a Myrna Loy lookalike. She went back to her parents in Cleveland for the summer. She's afraid I'm going to vanish into the universe. Poof! Just like that. She's bewildered, scared of me, but likes joining me in bed in her nightie that's too small for her. So one pretty tit sticks out. We stay up all night, talking and making love. She's going to stop shaving her armpits for me, French style. She wears green contact lenses and gave me an electric iron and wants to live in a treehouse. Who doesn't? I love her brown curly hair. Danny's got a new column in the Soho Weekly News called Danny's Dish. He read this journal, said it should be published word for word. It's so sexy, so brilliant, so real. He's a flatterer. Can't take it seriously. He got all misty-eyed over my friendship with Dupre, said it was very romantic. But my recklessness scared him, said it might kill me. There was a shootout on Thompson Street last night. Richard Hell comes over to read the introduction I wrote to the first television fan club zine. He sat there drinking peach schnapps and laughing at his favorite bits. He said, "Man, we were made for each other." Ork liked it too, said I'd gone above and beyond the call of duty. But then Verlaine summoned me to Max's to give me his 2 cents worth. Ever since he hooked up with Patty, he takes himself very seriously indeed, grooming himself to be the next Bob Dylan. I think he's been studying Dylan's cruel behavior in Don't Look Back. I sat facing him while he began a bizarre assault on me. "So, I'm just wondering. You get up in the morning, you pick out a shirt, you look in the mirror, you say, 'I'm Duncan Hannah, and I'm cute.' Do you stand in front of the mirror to perfect your smile? Is that what you do? Do I have that right?" "What?" I said, struggling to understand. "I read your thing. Let's get one thing straight. You don't understand me. You don't know me. You'll never know me, okay? Just remember that. You'll never know me." "Look," I said, "I'm not getting paid for this or anything. It was all for love of the band. Plus, Hell liked it." He smiled thinly and said, "Yeah, well, I'm not Richard." I got up and wandered over to Danny's table. Noticing my long face, he said, "What's the matter, baby?" I told him. "What did I tell you from day one? Musicians are assholes. He's an asshole. Spend your energies elsewhere." Hell came over to apologize for Verlaine's venom. One night at a television gig at Club 82, Steve Paul, Lenny Kaye, Dupre, and I pile into Lenny's trustworthy auto to smoke some dope and just generally see the streets from the inside of a moving vehicle. You know, just go for a drive. Lenny and Steve start riffing about how the front seat, them, is better than the back seat, us. So we lip off to them, being punks and all, and we're all so stoned. And Lenny's driving like a lunatic, and we lost Steve's file of supergrass somewhere in the back seat. And he's saying we stole it, and if we didn't cough it up in 10 minutes, they're going to drop us somewhere dangerous. Steve says, "Lenny, it's cash and carry around here, and it looks like it's going to be carry, whatever the fuck that means." I gotta pee, and the whole thing is getting weird. Lenny screeches to a stop in some desolate area, and Steve orders us to get out. I do, and they start laughing and say, "Get in!" It's all some kind of film noir goof. It had a sour taste. Somehow, we got back to the relative sanity of the 82. Domestic scene, Thompson Street, 4th of July. Dupre's parked in the corner smoking a cigarette, looking like an uninterested Keith Richards. 2 naked girls sit in armchairs, glistening wet from the bath, sipping coffee. They are groupies, but settle for me and Dupre when it's an off night. No good bands in town. They sleep and snore in our beds, exchange girl talk, do their makeup, apply pomade, recite movie queen dialogue, discuss tour schedules, who got Jimmy Page last time, who gets Robert Plant next time, etc. One slips on the floor and lands, boom, on her bottom. This cracks Dupre up. The downstairs neighbor bangs on the ceiling. Sid Barrett is on the hi-fi, singing, "You're the kind of girl that fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything, if you want me." I draw a felt-tip tattoo on Velvet's arm that says, "Lady Luck," enclosed in a heart. It looks like a southern whorehouse in here, or maybe the railroad car of showbiz types, and some like it hot. On my new 9-inch Panasonic black-and-white TV set, Alain Delon is saying in his heavily accented English, "I could love a girl like you. You're beautiful like a child. You say I am immoral, that I don't know wrong from right. But does it do any harm?" At night we go to the roof to smoke boo and watch the fireworks. It's like the end of the world. We walk over through the deserted meat market. There are television flyers that Lloyd has pasted up. We deface them with big dicks coming out of their jeans. Diamond Dog posters on building sites proclaim our doom. The fire hydrants are open and gushing, splashing over the bits and pieces of bottle rockets, cherry bombs, and black cat firecrackers. Smell of cordite, crescent moon, a tinge of the apocalypse in the air. Bachelorama. Summer, 1974. July 15th. We have the new German variety of cockroach that eats machinery. Another breed of Eskimo cockroaches that are cooling it for the summer in the icebox, sipping iced tea. "And you're a prima ballerina on a spring afternoon," sings David Joe from the speakers. A new establishment opened up on our block, down a few steps to a cellar. It's painted in red enamel, with ominous black stencil lettering that says, "Venus Social Club, Members Only." What could that mean? What goes on in there? The mind boggles. Is it like a Robe-Grillet thing? La Maison des Rendezvous? Can I join? Seems terribly sinister. One night, stumbling home from some serious drinking, I decided to chance it. I stepped down and opened the door and looked in to see half a dozen fat old Italian guys smoking cigars and drinking espressos. They looked up and stared at me. "Get out of here, kid," said one. "Yes, sir," I replied and beat a hasty exit. They must be mob bosses. So that's what they do with their ill-gotten gains? Sit around in a crummy basement drinking coffee? Where's the fun in that, I'd like to know? Hardly seems worth it. Use your imagination, guys. You're gangsters. Live large. An extremely pretty girl in a pale yellow summer dress orders a lemonade for me at Sutter's, Annette. She's a dead ringer for young Claire Bloom. She never takes her wide eyes and Mona Lisa smile off me, like she's in a trance. I give her the lemonade on the house, and she asks for my phone number. She says she speaks 5 languages. A couple nights later, Eric and I are drinking Pernod, and he's panicked at being broke, not having found a summer job. So I started singing 53rd and 3rd to him, the Ramones song we hear at CBGB's. 53rd and 3rd, I'm trying to turn a trick. 53rd and 3rd, don't it make you feel sick? "Oh yeah, what is that about anyway?" Eric innocently asks. "You know those young dudes who hang out under those arcades at 53rd and 3rd? They're male hustlers. That's what Dee Dee does," I explained. Eric and I often passed those tricks on our way to the cinemas up there. Eric was shocked. "That's what those guys are doing there? But Dee Dee has a girlfriend." "It's a job." "But it's so gross. Who are the clients?" Probably closeted businessmen who want a blowjob before they go home to their wives at night. They pull up in their car. Boy goes over, negotiates price, and they drive off to a dark street. But how much do they make? I don't know. $20 for 15 minutes? Something like that. Ick, says Eric, who is pretty homophobic, despite his androgynous looks. He even finds my camp shenanigans a little beyond the pale. I went to the bathroom to pee, and when I returned, Eric was gone. Then, the pretty girl I gave the lemonade to calls, wants to come over, and I'm ridiculously drunk. I figure it'll be a test. Will she still like me in my Mr. Hyde mode? If she does, she's got some metal to her. She arrives at the silver door that leads into the steamy kitchen. I introduce her to Dupre and lead her back to my leopard print bedroom. All the while, her big peepers are trained on me in a crazy way. I take her dress off and lay her down. A dark triangle on snow-white skin. Very beautiful. Very acquiescent. Lovemaking ensued. Then we collapse in the Burmese heat. I lit a cigarette. Eventually, she began talking. We knew each other before, remember? We were together in Hampton, exchanging secrets behind the curtains. We were just children, remember? No. Why do you refuse to remember? Remember how cold it was? Our thin arms holding each other tightly for warmth? The excitement in our eyes at the thought of being caught? As much as I might enjoy your flight of fancy, I do not remember any of this at all. You're talking about past lives, yeah? So this continued into the night. At about 3 a.m., she said, You're very close to Dupre, aren't you? I can tell. Yeah, he's my best friend. I like him a lot. I could sleep with him, she offered. Wait, what was that last part? I could sleep with him. Silence. He seems like he needs attention tonight, she explained. I was waiting for that. I said, Okay, go on then. She left and I went back to sleep. An hour later, she returned, stared at me like a wide-eyed loony. She told me to touch her. I lit a cigarette and peered out the window into the dark tenement air shaft by the head of my bed. I looked at the clotheslines, the alley cat down below, and a nurse getting dressed for work behind wicker blinds. I listened to the sound of wind and arguments. I felt claustrophobic. Have I broken something? She softly asked. Brother, I am out of my psychocosmic depth. Then, right on cue, who should come bounding in but Eric, drunk as a lord. I got up to see. He spilled his rent money onto the kitchen table. Where have you been? What did you do? I said aghast. I did what you told me to, and on the way home, I stopped at a real whorehouse. It had a red light on outside and everything, and I fucked a black girl as a test. It was a real adventure. I gotta go to bed now. I'm exhausted. He seemed quite happy, unmarred by his first taste of male prostitution. Meanwhile, I still had a naked astral traveler in my bed. Viva la vie bohème. After Miss Annette left in the morning, Dupre said, Thanks for the gift. What exactly happened? She tiptoed in and started to give me a back rub. Then I turned over, I realized she was naked, and the rest is history. She said you were cool with it. You are, aren't you? Yeah, sure, I guess. I think she's as mad as a hatter. I got that sense, too, he said. I often go to the Carnegie Hall Cinema, where foreign double features are $1.50 with a student discount, great programming, and a faux French cafe in the lobby. I saw a pretty young girl standing in line for a Fellini program. She was dressed in a black kimono with white dragons on it, and carried a well-worn black journal, art school girl. We exchanged phone numbers,